mathematicians. They were physicists in a rather simple way. They had already developed their knowledge of the atomic theory. They had many forms of knowledge. Knowledge would not have overwhelmed them. Even the discovery of some wonderful truth about science or art would not have changed the course of their lives profoundly, nor would these changes have been of great value to all of the initiates. Some of them might have founded schools, some might have become great and learned persons, but a percentage of these Eleusinian adepts simply returned to their own lives, to the commonplace things of their existence, but as new people, as in some way wonderfully spiritually strengthened. There doesn't seem to be any concept that we know of that could have produced this change unless it had been the actual experience of the one thing that all men fear, and that is death, or about which there is this inevitable sense of doubt, a doubt that more or less weakens our activity while we live, and a doubt that sends us with uncertainty and a certain amount of tribulation into the afterlife. All rituals of initiation, as we know, are based upon rituals of death. We know that the Egyptian rites were based upon the fact or the idea of a deceased person being led through the underworld. The whole concept then seems to be that the neophyte, the receiving initiation, was led through the realms of the dead and brought back to life again. Once having passed through these mysterious realms, whatever they were, and for all practical purposes, there is no real value in even trying to find out what these realms were. The only thing that was of immense value and immediate value was the experience of the individual of having a life apart from body. That the destruction of the body was not the destruction of life. That he survived the disintegration of the body as a conscious living being. Now, it is true that in the rituals the body was not disintegrated. But this perhaps also is not too important. For the important thing was the realization of a conscious existence separate from body. This may have been all that was needed or indicated. The sudden realization that the body and the spirit were not the same thing. The sudden realization that the life does not cease with the body. This in itself, were it communicated, or could it be communicated, to modern man, in toto, if the greater part of our leadership in this world could be composed of persons who had the full and complete factual experience of a life apart from body, and an almost certain anticipation of a continual condition of self after death, this in itself would change the entire course of human history. It would change every policy that we know. It would end forever this terrible thing which we call materialism. A materialism by which we lock man into a mortal world. Now, there are many persons who sincerely believe that they believe in immortality. That actually they can say, I don't need any such a proof. I don't need to experience anything like this. But even these people, while they are talking, are not living as though they believed it. They are living not with this full comprehension. For I know many people who believe in immortality who are profoundly selfish, self-interested, and profoundly resolved to get as far as they can in this world and let the next world take care of itself. This could not occur were the experience valid. It can only be the result of an intellectual acceptance without experience. So whatever it was that the Iliuscinia bestowed, it was the living experience of something. And think as we may and search as we will, there seems to be no other experience that is valid. There is no other experience which would utterly transform all men, or would produce so vast and inevitable a change in human character that the initiate was not only set apart, but in the common experience of life was found so worthy of veneration that even a king could not sit in his presence. These people were people of extraordinary power. They seemed to be people who had died and have lived again. They had something. They had been lost and had been found again, like the return of the prodigal son. Now, assuming that such a valid experience, or an experience so calculated that it seemed inevitably valid, did occur, we can say that in the records of a number of research groups in this country, incidents of this kind have been recorded. We know that many persons have had experiences that could also be explained in this way. But here there has been an isolated experience, contrary to the tradition of our people, contrary to the common acceptances of our daily living, an experience which the person may gradually talk himself out of, or think himself out of, or finally decide that what was a valid experience might have been a dream or some strange hallucination that crept over him. Change this, however, to an entirely different atmosphere. Bring this into harmony with the great tradition of your people. Bring it into the presence of those whom you most respect on earth as the true and valid interpreters of the gods. Not the clergymen of uncertain beliefs themselves, but those who were held to be the divine agents of divine purpose. Individuals whose own lives were exemplary in every way, whose wisdom was profound, and who were regarded with universal admiration and respect. Let them say these things. Let your own experience occur in these things, so that you experience truly that which your fathers have experienced, that now you are only affirming by your own participation that which has been held as the greatest good by all your people from the beginning. And you can see that we would have quite a different psychological atmosphere surrounding such an experience. It would be accepted as valid, because such validity had been assumed on it and based upon it since the beginning of the history of that culture. Now, about this period also, something else may have slipped in from other areas, or may likewise have been also indigenous. And that is the gradual relationship between the experience of conscious survival of death and the possibility of rebirth. We know that Pythagoras believed in metempsychosis. We know that he was a contemporary of Buddha who taught the doctrine in India at about the same time. We know that Pythagoras was in India. We know that Hindus reached Greece as students of the Greek mysteries and the Greek colleges. We also have every reason to suspect that a nation does not have to derive this belief entirely from borrowing. And if they had wanted to borrow it, they could probably have found it no further away than Egypt. We know that Plato was generally addicted to this opinion. And we therefore realize that to him, the idea of re-embodiment was not strange, distant, or difficult. it would not have been of any particular value to have included reincarnation per se in the mysteries, because it was already publicly taught. But there could have been a very valid relationship between the conscious experience of immortality and certain further insight into the relationship between the survival of consciousness and re-embodiment. Here we would come into a more complicated and advanced field from which we might gain greater insight and which might well lead the student of a great philosopher to seek out the mysteries in order that he might receive additional insight. For wherever and whatever the mysteries existed and taught, the additional insight factor must have been present, or they could not have held their spheres of influence. Now, if we wish to assume that the Greeks did create the experience of conscious separateness from the body, that also they probably taught in their rituals the metempsychosis, or the sequences of rebirth, it only then leads a very little way to the true theurgy of the Neoplatonists, namely how the experience of the fact of survival can become the basis of a great science of human regeneration, and how through this understanding and insight, man may become acquainted with those secret arts and secret sciences which deal with that part of his life which is invisible and is transubstantial. We then might very well come into almost any of the concepts that we find in yoga, Vedanta, and then again, disciplines for the increase of man's ability to experience liberation from one world and transcendence in another. Disciplines for the attainment of internal consciousness. Disciplines for the regeneration of this instrument that did depart at death, or was consciously separated by the ritual of initiation. For here, presumably, if the individual suddenly found himself to be alive and not in a body, it would be inevitable that this would bring with it certain imponderable problems, one of which would be the continuance of this unbodied person, what he is like, what his nature is, what kind of a condition he must live in, where he must go, or if he is coming back, when and how he will return. Suddenly, a new world of necessary knowledge opens up, the knowledge of the right conduct of the unembodied, the knowledge of what condition or place this unembodied one will occupy between embodiments. And it is reasonably certain that this unembodied person would not find himself in the inferno of Hesiod or in the strange dark underworld of the Homeric legends. He would not find a universe like the pictures drawn in some table of Cebes by some artist under a kind of inspiration. He would undoubtedly discover and would have to face the nature of himself alone, to do as Plotinus says, experience that journey, which is the journey of the alone to that which is forever alone. The individual suddenly separated from body is separated from the whole body of knowledge. He is separated from practically everything he has ever learned. For in his unembodied state, all these arts and sciences are meaningless. The fact that he is a good salesman no longer means anything. the fact that he has accumulated, the fact that he has achieved worldly dignity, the fact that he is adjusted socially to some community in which he lives, these things suddenly lose cast and face. They are unimportant anymore. But there are other things that suddenly have to become important. Among these things, the mystery of the individual existing with himself, the kind of an existence which goes on beyond the portals that divide us from the other world. Thus, it would be perfectly natural to assume that perhaps Plato was working upon a part of the initiation ritual, coming as near to it as he dared to come, when he began to philosophize on the problem of the preparation of the human soul for an existence out of body, that this preparation has to begin here, that from the time the individual is initiated, in the Greek sense, that is, become participant in the state mystery, we must ponder and consider that he is moving inevitably toward a state which he now knows, which he has now experienced, which he knows is not the end of his own memory, the end of his own hurts or grudges or difficulties, which he simply knows is the continuance of himself without body. Now, if this situation struck home to Plato, and it seems that it did, and through Socrates, Plato expounds many of his own philosophies, then it seems quite reasonable to understand the meaning of the philosophic life, why it is that the wise, whether they be Grecians or Buddhists, have always contemplated a course of conduct which was equally valuable in this world and valuable after this world ceases. By the ceasing of the world, we do not mean the end of the world, but the end of our place in the world. So if the Greeks had this concept of immortality, which we know they had, and were able to bring home to the individual, even for the tenth of a second, the total experience of his own unembodiedness, then a new universe of needs, a new universe of purposes, must suddenly blaze open in the consciousness of this person. Whereas man in our present way of life comes in the end to his mysticism. By the Greek theory, apparently, man was invested with this mystical experience first. Then it was his duty to fulfill that which he had received. It was his duty to make a fact in his daily life that which had been given to him only upon the vision of the Hierophant. So now a great esoteric doctrine comes into existence. An esoteric doctrine that has not to do with all kinds of universal magics and mysteries, which has not to do with the control of elements or the talismanic formulas which have to do with success and security in this world. It is no longer a world of white magic or of black magic. Transcendentalism now becomes simply the esoteric science of man's eternal state, a state which does not essentially change whether he is bodied or unembodied. A state, however, which he loses sight of while he is embodied. So now comes this possibility, which is well and clearly shadowed in the writings of Plato, that your true esoteric doctrine in the Greek philosophy was this outline, this planned purpose, this way of instruction for the soul which faces unembodiment. If this concept was expounded in the mysteries, then we can see how it could be arcanely set forth, as the Greeks themselves called it, to the mystic, in the mystae, those who saw through a veil darkly, or those between whom and the truth was this veil of ceremony and allegory, and those who finally saw face to face, who were brought into the living and eternal presence of the mystery itself. If in this situation, then, the person now absolutely certain, because he had passed through the experience himself, that he was a citizen of eternity, that he would be re-embodied, that he would come and go until the impurities and imperfections of his life were exhausted, and then in the end, as Pythagoras is reputed to have said in the golden verses, he will ascend into space and heaven and be one once more with the gods. That this pageantry, then, has to deal with this. That it has to deal not only with survival, but with the state of consciousness in survival. Perhaps the condition the individual occupies here has something to do with the way he is going to feel, the degree of light or darkness which will be within his nature when he is unembodied. Perhaps the Greeks would tell us, as Plato did, that if the individual departs from this body totally unenlightened, without any contemplation or consideration for the mysteries, without any striving within his own nature for improvement or self-discipline or self-direction, that in this other state he might very well be utterly confused, wandering, limping, like Cori searching for her daughter, unable to follow a straight line, obscured, or as the Greek fable says, the soul coming out of the body intoxicated with worldliness. That instead of rising serenely from this body, it is in a drunken stupor. It is unable to exist clearly. It is unable to orient itself in this other life because it has never oriented itself in the mortal life. Whereas, on the other hand, the soul, purified in life, already contemplating its own immortality, aware of the principles underlying the cycles of life and death, and having achieved certain disciplines and temperances of itself, achieves the initiation in which the soul separates itself from the body rather than the body separating itself from the soul. The soul, therefore, in conscious freedom, achieving its own tranquility and equilibrium in space, and thereby enabled to proceed along whatever mystic course shall lead to its fulfillment. Thus, in the Greek rites, I think the real answer lay in this discipline for immortality. That in some mysterious way, these rituals either actually produce this phenomena, or so skillfully represented it through some artificial means, that as far as the candidate was concerned, for him it was a certain, solemn, and inevitable fact. Something that he no longer could say, I think, I hope, I believe, I wish, but would be forced out of honesty to his own nature to say without equivocation, this I know. If this knowledge of immortality was then conferred, the individual inevitably began to contemplate a universal destiny. He was no longer bound within the narrow circle of things. Now, what did he see beyond this? Did he actually behold, as Apuleius says, a blessed spectacle? Did he perceive unfolding around him the universe of causes? Again, from the visions of Plato, we gain some possible insight in this. it is quite conceivable that in this moment of freedom, man beheld the mighty hierarchs of the world, that he beheld these very things that St. Paul describes in the blessed visions of those who are the firstborn of them that sleep, and those that sleep are the uninitiated. Perhaps something of the strange ecstasis of Dante, in which he beheld the vast orders of the universe, perhaps in that moment in which consciousness was relieved of the limitation of matter, the individual experiencing his own survival experienced also the blazing testimony of the spheres. Perhaps a world of vibration, of energy, of light, color, sound, form that we know nothing about suddenly became reality. Perhaps this was the abode of the blessed gods. Perhaps he then beheld these gods as the radiant principles they are, suspended like effulgent blossoms from the heavens. Whatever may be the ceremony, it is known that of this the initiate would not speak. We can understand why he would not speak. We can understand that to those who did not possess the insight, speech would be useless, he would merely be turned mad. And if he might be even tempted to speak, how could he, in the presence of those obligations which he had taken? Perhaps if it had only been a theatrical pageant that he beheld, or some formal rite which he had attended, these obligations would not have rested heavily upon him. But now, having experienced a world of divine things, the very world of gods from whom these obligations were imposed, it would be indeed a strangely profane and perverse person who in the presence of such an experience would be false to the rules that govern it. Therefore, I think we may say that the candidate naturally and inevitably did not communicate, that he held these matters to be the most sacred of his life, and would probably, as some of the Greeks are said to have, suffered torture rather than to reveal the mysteries. Now, if this seems a little extravagant, I doubt if we will find it to be so as an explanation for this peculiar ritualistic situation. And let us think for a moment now what happened when the mysteries of Greece finally drifted into the Roman Empire. But now we come to another problem. We know that the Romans were a very strange people that seemed to have suffered from a profound inferiority complex. Like most great materialistic states, the Romans were keenly aware of their own ignorance. They knew they were barbarians and admitted it. They knew they were very successful barbarians. They knew that they could conquer culture, but they could not attain it. They realized that to the Greeks they would always be a group of uncouth barbarians. They could control the bodies of the Greeks, but Greek learning could not be controlled. And gradually, as part of the spoils of war and conquest, the Greek mysteries were transferred to Rome. Now, in all probability, with very, very few exceptions, the Greek mysteries never reached Rome, actually. It is very doubtful if the Greeks ever permitted the theophany of the mysteries to be practiced among the Romans. It is quite possible that some of their priests, some of their hierophants, still possessed this knowledge and could at will confer it. But I think that it was at the time of the transference of the mysteries to Rome that what we call the esoteric part was simply wiped away. It was never revealed. The Romans received the body of the ritual, But whatever it was that led to this experience of eternity, the Roman was not able to take. Whether it was merely a matter of the fact that he could not or would not fulfill the obligations of the mystery, or whether by his very background he was unlearned, and by being such a savage was unacceptable to the priest, we don't know. But it was in Rome that the great rituals, for example, of the Dionysiac descended into the orgies of the Bacchanalia. It was here that all of the great institutions of Greek learning were profaned. And it was also from this area that most of the opinions of modern writers about these mysteries originate. Why? For the simple reason that at this time there was nothing to conceal. Oaths and obligations were not taken seriously. The mysteries were exposed, but by this time there was nothing to expose, which was precisely the point that the Greeks were careful to protect. The time that the mysteries reached Rome, then, the true rites were no longer practiced. Now, whatever the rituals and rites were, undoubtedly could be practiced if the need arose, at least for a time, although it is possible that with the passing of several centuries, the secrets died out. There is a reason to believe that the Greek rites were practiced and observed with these magical and mystical parts as late as the 7th or 8th century of the Christian era. By this time, however, they had mingled their courses with the early Gnostic and other esoteric societies and were simply no longer state mysteries. They were then mysteries of secret schools of teachers, and the beginning of the adept tradition in the Western world. But, occasionally at least, these rituals were conferred, apparently legitimately, upon certain Romans. There is every reason, from what we are able to learn, that Cicero was initiated. That he was not initiated into the Bacchanalia, but was initiated into the genuine Dionysian rites. From this occurrence and from this circumstance, we can understand what he meant when he said that these sublime mysteries not only teach men to live well in this world, but to meet the world beyond with a good hope. This, I think, is the key to it. I think perhaps Cicero has unwittingly told the story. Another who was definitely initiated was the Emperor Julian, who was initiated at Ephesus and was initiated in the ancient way, receiving the full ritual and the mystery, whatever was being at that time practiced. And Julian probably deserved it, inasmuch as he had been all his life a profound student. He had been of considerable attainment in philosophy, though he does not compare with Plato or Plotinus. Still, he was a Neoplatonist in his own right. His great hymns to the sovereign son and the mother of the gods indicates true enlightenment. And therefore, it is quite reasonable to suspect that the initiation which was given to him at Ephesus was genuine. Another who was certainly initiated, and so refers to it in his own writings, was Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, whose meditations are among the great masterpieces of world literature. Marcus Aurelius was, by nature, not what we would normally call a mystic, nor what we might possibly call a stoical philosopher, with a certain eclecticism, with a certain striving after all knowledge, seeking everywhere for a truth that would sustain him. And in the sorrows and burdens of his life, Marcus Aurelius was very obviously strongly supported by sources of strength and courage within his own consciousness. It's very probable from what we can learn that the initiation of Marcus Aurelius was genuine. So the Roman period did have fragments of the mysteries, but I can find no records, actually, that any of these Roman initiates, Cicero, Julian, Antoninus, or many of the others, were actually initiated in Rome. They seem to have had to go to Greece, or one of the outlying Greek states, or one of the boundary states between the actual area of Roman supremacy and the unconquered world. It was only in the outskirts of the empire, far from the pressures of imperial despotism, that the genuine mysteries were conferred during the period of the Roman Empire. As far as we are able to learn also, the Emperor Justinian officially forced the closure of the Greek mysteries. He did so after his conversion to Christianity, on the grounds that not that these mysteries were so different or so heathen, but because perhaps there was too close an affinity. So by that time, there seems to be no indication that the Christian rites retained the actual experience of the resurrection. In other words, the Christian ritual of the early centuries undoubtedly had something to do with this death and resurrection mystery. This resurrection of man from the mystery of body. But by the 6th century, this had disappeared in Christianity and at least had retired to a symbolic state. Whereas in the Greek mysteries still celebrated outside of the Roman area of influence, there is possibility that the old rites with the actual experience of immortality were still conveyed. If such was the case, we may understand why Justinian attempted to achieve the closure of all these mysteries, and why some of them did escape, some into the Near East and some into Gothic Europe, where they were to reappear again behind the great Nordic cycles and behind the Gothic cults and sects of the early Middle Ages. The Greek rituals, then, I believe, quite definitely, had to do with this idea of the abduction of Persephone, which was the ritual of the lesser rite. In this abduction, a final arbitration is achieved, and Persephone is allowed to return to the upper world half of the year, and remained as Queen of Hades the other half of the year. From this, Taylor and most others have derived the concept that this represents the state of the soul, which for a certain period of time is embodied in the material world, which is equivalent to Hades, and then is released for an equal period of time to the superior world, which is the world of the unembodied. Thus, this arbitration places the soul in a cycle of necessity between embodiment and non-embodiment, which seems to be the burden of the legend of Persephone and her abduction. The greater ritual has to do with Kore, or Ceres, the goddess of the harvest. It has to do with the mystery of the grain sheaf, the very same grain that was held up by the Hierophant of Eleusis as the symbol of the Mater Deorum, or the mother of the gods. Kore, carrying in her hands torches shaped like great blazing trumpets, circles the space and stars and skies of things, trying to restore her daughter, Persephone, to the upper world. She is desirous above all things that a daughter shall be relieved from this partial imprisonment in the realm of Hades, and shall come back forever to abide with the gods, because she is the goddess of spring, and when she comes back, all things become green and young again. Now this wandering, this weeping, this terrible course of struggle, by means of which Persephone searches for her daughter, like another parallel fable of Orpheus descending into the underworld to rescue Eurydice, these legends and fables would all seem to indicate the philosophical mystery of the disciplines and the secrets by means of which the soul is liberated from the underworld and returns forever to the realm of light. This foreverness back to light perhaps is suggested by the Parinirvana of the Buddha or the Samadhi of Vedanta. It is the final emancipation of the soul from the tyranny of the kingdom of Hades. So these rituals could very well symbolically express the point, convey the idea and all that it implies, but must have finally consummated, not in symbolism, but in the living factual experience of that which was described. For in this way, not only was the neophyte initiated into the mystery itself, but he gained at the same time the clear means of interpreting fable. He became master of the fables of the ancients. He could now turn the key seven times in the lock of symbolism and could unveil each secret that had been revealed in the ancient beliefs of his people. Thus, by means of the symbolism, man became aware of the universe of symbols. He became conscious of the fact that everything has more than one meaning, and that the fable is the key to the mystery. Having experienced the mystery, we know the fable. Having interpreted the fable, we become masters of wisdom, because all wisdom is nothing but the eternal recovery of truth from fable, of fact from appearances, of reality from illusion. All these things fitted together could make and did make the great mysteries of the Greeks real and vital institutions. And without this final thought, which is fairly well supported by our Greek and Latin authors, I think we will never be able to solve the real meaning of the mysteries. For the mysteries could only be the experience of being lifted up into life, an experience which itself is the end of man's existence in darkness. For once he knows the light, he can never again be captured completely in the darkness. Well, time is up, so we'll try it again next week.